Welcome to the Dividend Talk Podcast, episode 192. Earnings season has started again, and sectors we want to own more. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just getting started, Dividend Talk is the place to be for insights, analysis, and unsalted advice on how to make the most of your money through dividends with our own unique European flavor. I'm your co-host, Engineer My Freedom, and today I am joined by European DGI. So sit back, relax, and join us as we dive into the world of dividend investing and discover the power of passive income. Hey, European DGI. Earnings season again is upon us. How do you feel about it?
Well, that goes quick, right? We just finished reading all the, you know, annual earnings from last year, and now straight away into the quarterly earnings. It's always a busy season because I don't know how it's for you. It's also very busy at work. I was abroad also this week. And, you know, just to keep up, takes us a lot of time. But, you know, it's good that we have this podcast. It keeps us sharp. Also the newsletter, the premium newsletter that we have. So, yeah, it's really also very interesting looking into it. Also, stock market has been giving us some opportunities. Some even called already again a candy store, right? Including myself, maybe. But yeah, I said pretty amazing, I must say. I feel really good with this. And how about you?
Yeah, I'm actually surprised I missed Walgreens earnings. That's usually the calling card for me to say earnings season has started. So I'm not sure if they have or haven't. Maybe because I sold them, I don't get that notification anymore. So it just kind of sprung on me that earnings was here. It was Johnson & Johnson this period, actually, that triggered me. They had some news and released news about dividend as well. So we'll get into that. Look, we're going to talk about Johnson & Johnson and more of that. But before that, let's maybe jump into the news of the week. And I've spoken about Johnson & Johnson, and here they are again popping up on the news. And look, we know that they have this multiple litigations ongoing, and one of them is around this baby powder. And they seem to be having mixed results with that. Another case went in their favor. And actually, this time they're going to keep trying to file for bankruptcy again. So this will be their third attempt on that. They're not giving up on this bankruptcy hope.
Yeah, you know, I think they're still, you know, one of the best companies with a legal team, let's say. But, you know, litigation is so hard, right, in the States, so hard. And even I don't understand it, because I said it's about talc powder, right? Most by women with ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
I wonder how they got this. Do they get this as a baby or something like that, or do adult women use talc powder?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm going to assume it's for babies because it's baby powder. But I don't know.
We need to ask our female listeners. You can so much hear that we are guys, because I would not know what to use talc powder for as an adult. So we did this for the babies in the past, but. Yeah, you know, I for me, it is still looming over the stock, and you see that already for a year. I think also the valuation has come down over the year. If you look at the PE multiples, now trading at around below 150, yeah. So many would consider that quite an opportunity as well. But yeah, the risk is of course still here, and let's hope that they win a few more of these, right? Because they need it, and I know, you know. Morally, there's of course a very thin line, right? Because we look at it from an investor point of view. But if you're one of the victims, right, or a patient of this, and it comes due to this, I mean, that's just really, really bad. But for me, it's always hard to assess, like, what is a life worth? Yeah, how much should someone be compensated? We saw it with the Roundup cases where someone gets hundreds of millions. I mean, this is typically something American, because we don't know these kinds of things in Europe, really. So I just hope that G&G just settles this quick enough. It's about time. It's been looming for long enough, and I hope that the court can help here a bit.
Yeah, it's just interesting to me that they keep pushing with this bankruptcy filing, even though it keeps failing. they must be confident that eventually it will push through.
Yeah.
And then look, I suppose the key difference is when you look at Johnson & Johnson and someone like 3M, it looks like we're getting mixed results here. So they're winning some, they're losing some.
Yeah.
3M, they're losing everything. So it's it's interesting to watch it from afar, but it looks like they're going to settle at some point.
Yeah.
I honestly don't think that they would keep filing for bankruptcy unless they were confident that it stands a chance. So let's see.
And then other news, right? What was also interesting to me is just the overall stock market at the moment, because the S&P 500 is down, I don't know, 4% in the past week, which is a lot for this year. I think it's the first time it dipped more than 2% in this year. And the reason for this, from my understanding, is simply that Jerome Powell has effectively set higher interest rates for longer. So, you know, the stock market is desperate for some interest cuts. And who knows, maybe we may not even get them at all this year. We are already almost at the end of April. There was already one or two interest cuts expected, if you would have asked the analysts last year. And also the Fed was, you know, quite bullish at the time. Like, yeah, we're going to do a few. But the data just doesn't seem to improve. I mean, just all, how you say it, continues to go up and up and up. CPI, whatever it is, inflation is there also still. So, you know, there's not really a lot of reason to cut at the moment other than to satisfy the shareholders.
Yeah, I mean, look what America are doing. They're still printing money. They're bringing on a lot of debt. They have this major package that they are using for military aid, particularly with, I think, Israel and Ukraine now as well coming in. So, I mean, it's hard to see where these cuts are going to come in when you've got all these factors happening. So the market looks like it's lagging. What I think the market is over bullish on America at the moment, and for good reason when you look at it historically. But yeah, Powell, I mean, if Powell is investing, he has the market in his hands. All he has to do is just say a couple of words and he knows if the market's going to go up or down. It's crazy.
But, you know, it's very interesting because there are now quite some stocks that are that many people are interested in. If you now look at social media, it's Hershey, Starbucks, companies that have been always very expensive for a long time. And now they are approaching the 3% yield. Yeah, for a first time in a long time. Even Johnson & Johnson, right? What is it now? 3.3% or something like that? 3.4% yield? I don't remember when it was yielding like this for the last time. So it's clear that some stocks, and this is what I always like to say, right? It's not a stock market, but a market of stocks, because some stocks are really now into this zone that is historically, from a yield point of view, very interesting. And it also shows how dependent the S&P 500 is on a few of those tech stocks to keep it up, going up and up and up and up.
Yeah. And I think we mentioned that last week or the week before. These tech stocks, they are the glue that are holding that whole market together at the moment. And personally, I don't know how long that can go on for. We've seen this before. I think it was the Mag 6 back in the early noughties and the bubble burst. So I'd expect the same to happen. History rhymes, doesn't it? So I'd expect the same to happen at some point, and we might see a proper correction. But in terms of the companies we look at, there's definitely a lot more opportunities out there, particularly those with strong balance sheets.
Yeah.
And look, you know, I'm not as bullish as you are in Johnson & Johnson, but we can't argue with the strength of their balance sheet. So,
yeah,
it's interesting times, candy store times. We love it. We love
it.
That's what we're
here for. So also when you're listening, you know, always let us know what you buy or I said, what you're considering to buy, not because we see this as advice or something like that from your side, but just because it gives us inspiration. Yeah, sometimes we're also looking and scanning the stock market. What now? We have our list, but it's always nice to discover new dividend stocks. And the questions here that we get on the podcast also help a lot. So let us know, please, what candies you are buying in the candy store. I'm very, very interested. But companies, some of them, they don't care about share price. They will hike anyway. And I think the first one is one that you find always a bit interesting, is Sonoco Products Co., because they hiked the dividend by 2%. 42 consecutive year of increases and currently yielding 3.6%. And isn't this a company that you own or wanted to own?
Yeah, I have it on my watch list. They popped up to me when I was analyzing Smurfit Kappa, the Irish packaging company.
Yeah.
And these guys have, I mean, look, they're a bigger company. They have 42 consecutive years of increases. Albeit this is a small increase of 2%, it doesn't really excite you much, but a decent yield, 3.6% yield.
Yeah.
And packaging at the moment, look, inflation and all this kind of environment going on, it's a hard industry to be in. So it's probably not too disappointed in a 2% hike. So they keep their streak alive.
You know, you get it at a price to earnings for 11.7, but I mean, if you just look at the share price in the last 5 years, it's 9% down from where it was 5 years ago. So it just clearly shows, not just on the share price, but also dividend hike and such, that this is slow growing to a no growing company, right? So for me, it's a tricky one. So it needs to give you much, much more yield to compensate, because the yield is kind of the only thing that gives the return at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. And look, if you're going to compare this company to some of the other companies we talk about, it's not high on my buying list. It's just an interesting company in that segment, but there's definitely better investments out there. Yeah. And then our second, hey, this show is talking about Johnson & Johnson a lot, but they've also announced a dividend hike, and it's up 4.2% from 119 to 124. So that's the 62nd consecutive increase for Johnson & Johnson.
And not 6% this time.
It's not clockwork.
Do you think it starts to break the trend?
It's not clockwork anymore. We can't say it's clockwork.
They could have done 125, don't you think? And then you rounded up nice to €5 a year.
Yeah.
Somehow they wanted to be on 496. Is this because, do you think that this is a sign, like an early sign?
Yeah, and look, we're going to talk about earnings, and they're one of the companies that we're going to talk about. But what I did find interesting was the capital allocation strategy, where they mentioned competitive dividends.
No. Don't tell me this.
I have a screenshot. Capital allocation strategy, organic growth business needs, free cash flow, and then they have competitive dividends. It's right there. You can see.
Is this new or?
I don't know. And I went because we were only preparing this just before the show. I went to the last annual report and I did not see it in the last annual report. So I need to do a little bit more digging to see if it's new. But it just struck me, a company that has increased their dividends 62 years. So the commitment is there. It's real. But then I see competitive dividends. I'm like, oh no, please don't. Please don't do this to me.
Okay, now give us the earnings then, because now I'm getting nervous. I'm kidding, but you know, maybe not everyone that listens understands this, but when we see competitive dividends, we have seen this a few times before, a dividend cut. For instance, AT&T is the most iconic one, right? They said, like, we want to pay a competitive dividend, and everyone, yay, 6-7% at the time, poof, slashed through half or whatever it was. And many, many people burned themselves on it because the CEO was not really clear. But then after a few years, of reading those reports and everything, it was a few times that we saw this with competitive dividends. I don't know if Intel had it as well at the time. But it's typically when we see this and the company is in distress, we know, like, okay, if they change the policy to competitive, that means like a red flag.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it doesn't necessarily mean they'll cut the dividend, but what it means is you have to pay closer attention to their earnings.
Exactly.
It's going to marry that. But look, if you look at their earnings quarter, it was actually quite a subdued report when I was reading through it. Their overall sales was up 2.3%. US is quite strong as it usually is, especially if you exclude the COVID-19 vaccine. It was up 7.7%. But the biggest disappointment was in the international segment. And we know that's because of this patent cliff that is upcoming. That was actually down this quarter compared to previous quarters. It was down 2.3%. And then the worldwide was 2% growth overall. So you can start to see the effect of this patent cliff happening already on their earnings. In terms of their segments, so you know they've changed their segments. They have innovative medicine, medtech, and worldwide. So innovative medicine was up 1.1%. Medtech was actually up 4.5%, which I think we kind of expected. and worldwide was up 2.3%. So, I mean, look, there's nothing negative there. There's nothing bad apart from the international segment, which is down. But I don't get that feeling of clockwork like I used to get from Johnson & Johnson.
But that's also what we all the time say, right? The company changed. It's now a pharma and medtech company. We discussed it last week, I think, even in the show.
Yeah.
The consumer health was always giving this little cushion under it and there because, you know, it was a cash flow generating entity that also supports investments in other areas of the business, and that's been spun off. So it becomes a bit more sensitive to their pipeline, or actually very sensitive to their pipeline. Yeah. But you know, when I see this, right, $2.20 in diluted earnings per share, 2.71 adjusted, because they typically take the R&D out of amortization out of it, like all the other pharma companies, and then knowing that they pay 1.24 in dividends, I mean, They have a long time to go before the dividend really gets under pressure with such PE multiples, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at this and you look at the share price, I don't think it warrants the drop that we've seen off. And then couple that with our balance sheet.
I mean, how many companies have AAA? I believe only Microsoft, Johnson & Johnson, Apple.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not, as I said, clockwork, it's not mind-blowing, but it's actually not a bad report either. So
it could
present more buying opportunities, especially when they're yielding, is what was it, 3.35%?
Yeah, so that's really unique. I don't remember when it yielded like this. It was, I think, during COVID, if I remember correctly, the last time. Usually it's yielding around 2.7%, something like that. So it's very, very interesting. So people that are really considering to have Johnson & Johnson as a cornerstone of their portfolio, they should really have a look at it and then reassess. And if they have the conviction, this may be one of those times that it's actually interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who knows where the stock will go, but yeah.
So let's maybe move on to...
Let's do Snap-on because Snap-on is another stock that reported their earnings, the first quarter 2024 earnings. And maybe you see a pattern here, because this company had a very slight decline in their net sales by approximately, I mean, generally organic sales was 10 million down. The company was maybe 700 million in total. 700 million, 700,000 down, but 10 million in total. But, you know, they compensated a little bit of growth via acquisition and then positive currency. So the stock went also down 4 or 5% since the earnings report. Because, of course, we all would have expected proper sales growth, right? But it may just show that the consumer is a little bit more, you know, keeping the hand on the purse, as we say, at the moment. Inflation is real. But yeah, what they have been doing, because earnings were still up quite well. The earnings per share was 4.91 compared to 4.60 in the last quarter. So still like a 6.7% growth. How they did this? They just had lower expenses. Effectively, they were just very efficiently managed in the first quarter. So the gross margin was good. Yeah, 50.5% at the moment. So from that point of view, I understand that the company got punished on the stock market, because, you know, if you have flat growth, yeah, I think you deserve a little bit lower multiple than what it was trading for. But you know, the main struggling business unit are their tools. They're just struggling with this one, because it lost about 37 million compared to last year. So 7% organic sales decline, which is really, really a lot. But then the repair systems and information group, which is also interesting, grew their sales by 3.3% again. So maybe people buy less tools and just repair them more. Yeah, maybe that's it. Here, But then, you know, we always say free cash flow is king. So I go to the cash flow statement, and what do I see there? A free cash flow of 287 million versus 229 million in the same quarter a year ago, which is an increase of, what is it, about 20% year over year. So, and then I feel like, yeah, you know, this company is just so well managed, a very, very strong balance sheet. So, you know, I think this company is just feeling the consumer at the moment. Yeah, that's maybe not spending so much as it used to do. But then bottom line, they continue to grow because they can just save more on their operating costs. So, yeah, I don't know if they can sustain this in the upcoming quarters. The company itself thinks that they're, I said, doing quite okay. They're also still on their outlook. Didn't really change. They still expect just to keep up with their trend. So, yeah, all in all, not the best earnings quarter. I think we would have all liked to see some growth. But bottom line, due to their operational efficiency still just making proper earnings growth.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I still feel this company is overvalued. So I wouldn't mind another quarter like this where we see another 15% drop in share price, because back in 2020 was a really good time to buy them. So we'll see. Look.
That's the thing, right? Sometimes, so for me, it's now again around my entry criteria, 2.75. Then I look at the what is the earnings multiple, and then I think like, well, you know, not too bad either. So maybe this is just a time that it's worth further looking into. I mean, it is a price to earnings of around 14, 15-ish. That's really not that bad for such a company, which has been growing for the dividends about 10-13% year over year. Let's say compound annual growth. They have a payout ratio of about 40%, free cash flow CAGR 5 year of almost 11%, a return on capital employed of 20-21%, and 35 years of dividend growth without any cut in between. So, yeah. Not too bad, not too bad. You could consider it maybe even such a chowder stock, right? Where you go for a score of 12.
Yeah. It's
so for starting position, I'm really thinking about it. I need to do a little bit still more research, but yeah, I'm really thinking about it.
Yeah. Nice one. Okay, and we'll finish up then with a European powerhouse, ASML. So look, just some of the highlights. The quarter one sales was 5.3 billion, which was midpoint of what they predicted in last quarter. Their quarterly net bookings is 3.6 billion. Nearly 700 million of that is this EUV system that they have. And they're expecting pretty much the same for quarter two. I think typically the second half of the year is stronger for them, which they've said. So look, they're bang on track with what they said. CEO Peter Wennick also has pretty much said that. He said, look, the first half of the year is pretty stagnant. Other companies are starting to come around from their own recovery, their own downturn, so they're expecting the second half of the year to be more positive. And we can see that when we look in their, when we look in their cash flow statement, because I was talking to you off air, I was looking at their net cash, and we can see that it is negative this quarter, and the main part of that is because of what they have is changes in assets and liabilities. And it took me some time to sieve through that to see what that is, but basically what that means is that their inventories actually increased, and it's a little bit higher as they're building up stock, and we'll start to see that offload in the second half of the year. So nothing too much to be concerned about. Pretty much bang on point of what they said last quarter, they're meeting that. So I'm probably predicting they're going to meet midpoint again in quarter two, and then the second half of the year will be quite stronger. They also raised their dividend by 5.2%. So their total dividend is now €6.10, which is actually quite a decent raise.
Yeah. I was a little bit concerned about their net bookings, yeah, their order book, because it's quite a significant drop.
Yeah.
And, you know, does this have to do with China as well and the restrictions on there?
Quite possibly.
So, you know, I think the whole the shareholders were expecting more, on this one, the order book. So when I read this, I thought, okay, this is probably the main one why this stock also got punished a little bit in the stock market. But you know, it's a monopoly. Yeah, it's simple like that. So people will need to buy this stuff, companies.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we've said this before, but they're a good yardstick of what's coming for the chip industry. So I think second half of the year, we might see better results from our friends such as Intel and so on.
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah, I'm glad that I own one full share of this one. It's been doing me really well.
Well, you've got a 5.2% dividend hike from it, so.
I'll add it to my sheet to get a few pennies more.
Yes.
He who doesn't respect the little ones, right?
Every little counts. I think Tesco say that. So the second half of the show, we're going to talk about sectors we like to own more of and why. And I think this was inspired by Alexandris, who asked the question on Facebook. And it just really triggered us to look at our portfolios, see what our sectors are, and pinpoint actually what are we missing and what do we need to add to. So.
Yeah, so maybe a little bit about my current portfolio allocation. So the biggest sector in my portfolio is with 17.4% is information technology, slightly followed by consumer staples with 17.2, then healthcare with 14.9, then financials 14.8. So these are all these insurance stocks that I've been gobbling up together also with T. Rowe Price. Then energy with 14.3%, real estate investments trust with 10.2%, materials 4.9, so that's Rio Tinto and BHP, and then industrials with 3.5%. So if you take this into consideration all, where I really would like to grow actually is in consumer staples. So it's my second biggest sector, but 17.2% is still too low for me. It should be at least 20%, because you know, consumer staples, these are really serving the bottom of the Maslow pyramid: food, basic goods that everyone will need, whether it's a pandemic is happening in the world or not, we will still consume this. And every time when there's a crisis or something like that, they don't even drop so much in share price. Not that that's so relevant, but you know, if you then look at the big ones, they don't need to cut the dividend either in such times. Think about PepsiCo, Walmart, you know, they continue growing the dividends. It's not like people stop buying at Walmart. Actually, to the contrary, they would save rather money on going to restaurants and just cook at home, and they buy the ingredients then at Walmart, right? That's the typical behavior of these kinds of defensive consumer staples. So I would like to have a little bit more from this in my portfolio. They haven't really been on sale for a while, so maybe that's why it declined, because you know, I don't buy every month or every quarter with this in mind. We know that sectors come and go in the trends. My target allocation is at least 20% here, so I could use some more of this. At the moment, my biggest positions are Koninklijke Al Dalhousie, followed by Unilever, Danone, Hershey, PepsiCo, Target, and Ambra, the wine maker here in Poland. And I could definitely own some more PepsiCo and Target as an example from this list. Maybe even some more Hershey as well. But also, like I mentioned before, like Walmart is something that I find interesting here. So this is from consumer staples. But then I also mentioned industrials being my lowest one here from the sector. Yeah. And this one also needs to grow. Industrials, unlike consumer staples, are much more sensitive to this. But here I'm looking at those companies that stand out that I just would like to earn some of. Siemens, Schneider Electric, and Snap-on, SSS, you could say. But I don't have Schneider Electric as an example. I really like this company. It's one of those French companies beyond the luxury brands that I think deserves a place in my portfolio in the future.
Yeah,
and then Siemens we've spoken so often about, and Snap-on we just spoke about it. And I think these are good industrials that still offer a safe dividend profile.
Yeah, man, I really regret not loading the truck up on Siemens when they were under 100. I remember talking about it so much on the show and just never pulled the trigger at the time. There was probably other stocks that were around, but I sincerely regret that. But yeah, I think Siemens and Schneider Electric are two definitely deserve to be in your portfolio.
Yeah. And you know, this growth in those two sectors should come at the cost of energy and financials.
Yeah.
So I don't really expect financials to be big because only insurance stocks are mainly in there. And energy, yeah, it is just big because they've been loading up in oil and gas in the past. Yeah, and let's say in the accumulation phase. But if there would ever be a crash again, I could still own a little bit. But generally, I think it's reaching its target size for me.
What about materials? I noticed that's quite low as well.
Yeah, I don't find them interesting enough. I mean, I've got Rio Tinto in there and BHP. They are not even dividend growers. They cut them quite from time to time. So it's more like a high dividend play. I don't find this industry... I don't see really stocks there that pay a growing dividend.
Yeah.
So they pay large dividends, but often cut, so very volatile. And I don't want them, or I don't want too much of that in my portfolio.
Yeah, just opportunistic to avail of that.
Yeah, exactly.
I get you. Yeah, I can see why you're attracted to consumer staples. And but if I look at my portfolio, they actually make 22% of my portfolio, so I'm not looking in that direction at the moment.
Yeah.
If you look at my top three, it's financial services, which is quite high at nearly 40%. I think that's a lot to do lately with, well, maybe over the last 9 months, with all the insurance companies that I've been buying. Real estate is probably not a surprise. That's there. I'm pretty bullish on Vici. I've been buying Agree Realty and Realty Income as well. Utilities is next, and then after that everything is quite low. The two big ones that are missing, so I have a few shares in healthcare and companies like Johnson & Johnson, but not meaningful enough for it to make it onto my list. So I think healthcare and technology are definitely two areas that I need to improve on. What's not shown here though is that I do have investments in closed-end funds. And one of those funds is JP Morgan Income and Growth Investment Trust. It's actually a new addition to my portfolio, but they are tech heavy as well. So they got a lot of the big tech, and they have some dividend growers, so they try to do a mix of that. So I'm sort of, because my technology as part of a dividend growth portfolio is quite difficult to find fair value ones, first of all, and then pay a consistent growing dividend. So I think that's a good bridge into that world. And they give me that security of I can own them, but they also have this dividend growth policy where they grow at about 5 or 6% per year. Healthcare, on the other hand, is a sector that I really struggle with. I've mentioned Johnson & Johnson, trying to understand the pipeline that they shifted, and it's probably one of the reasons I didn't buy more and more as their share price is dropping, because they got rid of that consumer staples and you have to really understand what they're doing. One that sticks out to me is Bristol Myers Squibb. They seem so cheap, right? And they really do, and they have solid cash flows, and you can see that their dividend history is quite strong. And everywhere I've been looking, everyone's saying they're so cheap, they're a buy. I've been seeing that for 18 months. I think you bought them maybe 18 months ago.
Yeah.
But where I struggle is they're cheap because they have this patent cliff coming up.
Yeah.
So how do they replace that? They have to go to new products and acquisitions. And I just don't know how comfortable I am at being able to. Yeah. So I feel like it's more of a gamble for me. And I'm kind of following the herd if I just buy that without truly understanding it. I think that's why I probably invest more in real estate, because I can understand that it's tangible.
Yeah.
Consumer staples, I can understand that. Even financial services, it's easier to understand. So
that's. Yeah, pharma is hard, right? I can tell you how I look at Bristol Myers. I was looking at the patent cliff as well. And I was looking at, okay, what if this drug is not being sold anymore? How would the earnings look like? Yeah, and how much free cash flow is coming in now, and what can they do with it? So if you look at it, I felt like, okay, then actually at the current multiple, it feels like this is all a bit priced in. Yeah, that the future earnings or future cash flows are already discounted into it. So that's why I feel comfortable and why I'm not selling them, as an example. Of course, it stays a very small position for me, and it's a tier four, so to say. But that's the reason. But to your point, there's elevated risk here in this stock.
Yeah.
It's really a question of not only risk, but also reward.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And look, as part of that exercise, just before when I was writing out this, I did a quick search, as I'm sure people do out there. And I just typed in best undervalued healthcare stocks to buy now, right? And I usually ignore these lists because I find most of them bullshit, right? But this is the list that they gave. And you can see why I stay away from healthcare. Top of the list is Bayer. We know the troubles that they're having at the moment, okay? And that's number one. Second on the list is Bausch & Lomb, which I think is more medtech than pharma. They do contact lenses. Then we've got Royalty Pharma. I don't know them. Roche Holdings, we speak about them. I can see the attraction there. We've got Fresenius Medical Care, just cut their dividend in lots of trouble, overly complicated. And then you got Pfizer. And Pfizer did well during COVID, and now we can see that they're struggling a little bit. So you can see why it's so hard to pick something in this industry.
Yeah, true. I mean, that's part of the industry. Yeah,
it's hard. So what I might end up doing is something similar to what I do with technology, and look for an investment trust that's managed by someone else that has more experience in that, and hopefully get dividends from them instead of me doing the work myself. So
yeah,
that's where I'm going. So yeah, you can kind of guess I'm leaning more towards in investment trusts in the UK. You obviously get the tax benefit, and you get exposure to some of these industries that I'm not maybe more comfortable looking at myself. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think generally, you know, you're still early on in the accumulation phase. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think you need to put some effort behind it, but most of these things, they will equal out itself. I think so.
Over time, everything has cycles, don't they? So.
Yeah. But it is really funny that Morningstar has those as the 10 top stocks. It's very interesting. I sometimes wonder, like, if they only look at the metrics and don't take the fundamentals into account when I see that. Because let's be fair, Morningstar and its database and the white moat rating and everything is a very respectable way of looking at things, right? But then when I see those analyst reports sometimes with their top 10 lists, I think, like, guys, please. I mean, Pfizer in there as an example. We all know that it's a high yield stock, potentially a yield trap. Yes. So, and then Bayer in there. It's, yep. Yeah. But yep. Bayer is not difficult to put that below fair value.
Yes. Yeah? Yes. And I think that's why those two companies are there, because they give them credit. They do say that they have an economic moat of narrow or wide and trade below their fair value. And you can see that. But that just means everything else that's actually decent is not trading below fair value, in my opinion. So,
yeah, exactly.
I think it's also a good opinion, or a good example of staying away from these types of lists and not typing into Google best undervalued stocks, because you'll just get crap.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Hey, so shall we start with the listeners' questions? Because Fabian reached out by email, and shall we start with that one?
Yeah, of course. Let's do it. So he's asking about US insurance companies, and we've spoken a lot about European insurance companies, but he's asking, why do US insurance companies have much lower payout ratios and hence much lower dividend yields than their European peers?
So generally speaking, it has to do with the dividend policies. European companies tend to pay out, for instance, 50 or 60% of their earnings. And American companies, they usually focus on a growing dividend. And what this means is that, generally speaking, if you then take that as a baseline, that the European dividends are higher for that reason. Because, you know, if you're Apple and you pay 0.6% yield, and then you grow it, you continue growing it, let's say, between 5 and 10%. And they don't need to pay 50% of the dividends. I actually don't know how much they pay, probably 30% or something like that. but they focus on a growing dividend. And that's why it is also attracting a lot of us as dividend growth investors, because it provides this dividend safety as well, because they are not having this fluctuation where it follows the fluctuation of the earnings, right? But rather supported by a strong balance sheet and such. Yeah. That's the main reason.
And then the second part of his question is around brokers. And I think we get this question a little bit on the show, but he's worried about the unlikely event that one day it's possible to find his broker has been corrupted or emptied. Or, I mean, this sort of feels like it's a blockchain cryptocurrency exchange that go bust. But what if this was to happen to the Gyro or Interactive Brokers? How do you prepare?
Yeah, that's the issue with everything being digital, right? In the end, it comes down to trust. A lot, it can happen. I mean, if it would have been on paper, I think I would be more screwed, because I'm the person that forgets to open an envelope, and then it falls behind the heater in the home, and it's lost. So my house could burn down. I could be all the papers. They could also be lost. Otherwise, I would need to save it all at a bank. But then maybe the bank gets robbed.
Yeah.
So in this case, it's digital. Something can happen. Could all be gone. But if I wouldn't invest and would put everything on real estate, I don't know. Maybe a war would start in Poland with the Russians, and then, you know, my house would be gone. It's just very, very hard to protect your wealth. But it is to all of us a concern, but because we work very hard for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the end, for instance, I have three main brokers, and the two most important for me are the one, my favorite at the moment is Interactive Brokers, and the second one is the Gyro. Those are my two biggest brokers at the moment. And I have some rules in there as well. I don't want them to be too huge, and then I would just go for a third and a fourth if needed. I know it's not so nice from an admin point of view, but I sleep better at night thinking like that.
I agree. Actually, what I miss, not miss because I never had it, but share certificates to actually physically have them would give you a bit more confidence that they're safe. So now it's all digital, so you don't have a share certificate. And recently,
they're not even on your name.
And I had some hassle recently because I filed my taxes and they were looking for share certificates, and I was like, I don't have them. I can give you screenshots of what I own, but I don't have a share certificate. So it took 1 or 2 weeks, and I finally talked some sense. But yeah, a digital world is, look, it's scary.
Yeah.
But you have to trust. Yeah, I mean, you have no choice but to trust.
But I tell you, if I would have paper share certificates, I would lose them somewhere. Yeah. Like I mentioned, like they come yes, they would come in an envelope or something like that. And yeah, I would lose some of them for sure. Yeah, or forget about it. That could also be. I mean, that comes also at the admin, right? Now everything is done by the broker for us. It's nice on a list after you log in.
Yeah. Yeah. Pros and cons.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Pete Lee has asked us a question. Actually, he reached out to me a couple of times on email. He's very, very bullish on Johnson & Johnson. I wrote back to him with my, not completely negative, but my thoughts on him, but he's loading up the truck. Well, at least he mentioned he was. So I hope you have enjoyed the show, Pete, and let me know if you've bought more shares at Johnson & Johnson. But he's asked a good question. He said, "You're P&D, Joy. You're always going." No, he didn't say that. He said, "I hear you guys going on holidays so often. Have you ever considered losing out on activities with the family that cost money and invest instead?"
Definitely. If it wasn't me, I would go twice as much on holiday. So, but I can't, because I pay myself first, and which means investing. But for me, holiday is in my budget. Yeah. So also, when you think about my calculation for financial independence, retire early, holidays are in there, and it's true. You know, it's holidays. Sometimes it's also travel for work. I may combine it with a day here and there, but I think for listeners, they may hear we are abroad. Yeah. but sometimes it's also for work. But I mean, you only live once, yeah. And then I like to go on winter holiday. I like to go at least one time on summer holiday, but often twice. Then there are the breaks in between. I live in Poland, but I'm from Netherlands, so there's also again some holidays going on there and travel. I mean, life is good,
yeah.
And I love seeing the world. So, for instance, this is something that I splurge on. I don't go to 5-star hotels and everything like that. I'm still more on the frugal end when it comes to vacations. But I mean, vacations create memories for me and also for the kids. So it's as priority over other stuff.
I think when you have kids and they're young, your perspective changes because they're only young for a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
So you have to enjoy that time because eventually they'll get to 18, 19 and they'll flee the nest and then you can maybe save a bit more. But I think holidays, as you said, is important to create memories, in my opinion. So,
but that's a very Western European perspective because I spoke with some friends from Spain and they said, like, it's not uncommon to stay until you're 30 with your parents. Yeah. So maybe, I know we have quite some Spanish listeners, and I'm wondering now, like, how many are still with the parents? And I would say that's very smart because if that includes the holidays, then your holidays become much cheaper.
Yes. Mike has asked us about his portfolio. So he's working with a set maximum number of stocks in his portfolio. This means he has to cut out one share after adding another one. This helps him to not add impulsively and to only add if it will improve the overall quality of his portfolio. How would you guys make this work? How to decide which stocks to sell?
I think the ones that you have the lowest conviction for, just look at the list, check your conviction, look at the numbers, and take that one. It comes back to the show that we had a while ago where I mentioned I'm doing spring cleaning and such, so I do it once a year. But ideally, you don't want to touch it because it's kind of as a bar of soap.
Yeah.
So in the end, I would just say, Mike, just look at the ones where you have the lowest conviction for. I mean, you can start building all kinds of algorithms and such. But for instance, if you have something in your portfolio that you think like, why did I even buy it? Yeah. Those are typically the ones that you should have a second look at.
And in that case, I would not weigh one in, one out. If you have low conviction, kick him out now. Just get rid of them and then only buy ones you have.
And this changes, right? You might have had a strong conviction like 2 years ago. Like I had a bit of Viatris. Viatris is still my portfolio, but I don't have high conviction anymore. It's one of the stocks that I'm wondering like, should I keep it in?
Vladimir has asked us about insurance companies. Said DJI Communities like some insurance companies. However, they essentially absorb the risks of businesses in some sense, similar to banks, maybe with less risk. Buffett likes them, but not all of them, and developed his own unique view on it while he invested in a very specific way. What's your thoughts?
So, you know what I think about banks? Yeah, it's very simple. Also, if you look at dividend histories, insurance companies like Munich Re and such in Europe, they've tested time. If you look at the European banks and all the dividend cuts over the last 20 years, and then you look at something like Munich Re, Chubb, then I think, there's just much more to the business model that makes insurance companies more resilient to crises than compared to banks. In the end, the bank is a highly leveraged product in the end.
Yeah, I agree. Pulkit has asked us, how would you go about identifying starter stocks if you were to start investing today? And think about if you had a limited budget in your decision of around 150 a month.
I remember that when I started investing, that it was in my mind. For instance, it was easier to, and then this psychology, right? It was easier to buy, let's say, 7-8 shares of Shell.
Yes.
Then something big one share for something. So it works psychologically. You know what the beauty is nowadays? You have something like trading to one to in where you can create your own pie and you can put 150 a month in there in your favorite dividend growth stocks. So you could do that. But you could also just save up maybe one for 2 or 3 months and buy a bit more. But when it's such a limited budget of 150 per month, I will probably opt maybe even a little bit for a pie where I put a few in, or just go to trading to and to and buy fractional shares and just buy for £150, whatever it is, and then you take this kind of share price out of the equation.
Yeah, and fees are definitely important.
And Interactive Brokers also offers fractional shares nowadays. So yeah, actually, knowing the two brokers, I would even go to Interactive Brokers from that point of view.
Yeah. I think the fees are less on trading 212. That would be the only reason.
The currency is really impactful, and the spread. When I buy at trading 212, I lose quite a bit on the spread when they are buying automatically.
Yeah, but
it could easily be 1% of your value, which is a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, which might only matter when you're going to sell it as well.
Yeah. But then it's already 2% in total. Yeah.
David has asked us what do you include in the income calculation of FIRE. So pretty much all income that I earn outside of my main work. So dividend income is probably the only one that I have at the moment. That's pretty much it. I don't include my pension for reasons I've spoke of before. So it's all just additional income. That's it.
Yeah, for me as well.
Kevin has asked us a half serious question on investment safety. He said, if growth orientated investors can happily announce that they created alpha in any given period of time versus whatever benchmark they want, does that in fact mean that their defensive DJI portfolio went down only? Sometimes I find questions hard. No wonder.
It's really simple. What he's saying is that last week his portfolio, which is dividend growth investment portfolio, went down much less than the S&P 500. So, can we do now some bragging that we're beating the benchmark?
Yeah.
So, what do you think?
Of course, you can. You can brag all you want.
Yeah. Yeah, what is for me very interesting is that my portfolio at the time, 2 years ago or something like that, the wider stock market declined by more than 20% that year or something like 20%. And mine was like kind of flat there. And because I had energy in there, but generally also defensive stocks. So that was very interesting. So I usually don't get the full uptick in a good year, but I also don't get the full downtick in a down year. So maybe from a price, I would be like underperforming a little bit, but you know, from the other side, dividends are also part of the return, and my dividend yield is much higher than the S&P 500 there. So, look, I think Kevin, you may definitely do some bragging. Why not? It's part of the journey. It's part of being a proud investor and a proud dividend growth investor.
David has asked us about companies like Shell. What happens when they move from one stock market to the other? So they move from Amsterdam to the UK. So what happens to shares on the Amsterdam?
So the listing state in Amsterdam, there's still similar liquidity. Maybe there's a little bit more liquidity now in the UK because some investors would exchange their shares from euro dominated to pounds at that moment in time. But I'm still having them in the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. Same applies to Unilever. What did change is that the dividends are not anymore taxed at the company source. Of course, you still need to pay dividend tax depending on your legislation. So for instance, if you're in Poland and you invest now in one of those IKEA or IKEA, it's nicer because you get them tax-free, but I think most people would already have chosen the UK stocks because they were dual-listed before.
Yeah. Rafi has asked us to imagine we inherited 100,000 today and you want to use that as a down payment for a house, maybe in 2 to 4 years from now. How would you invest it?
I think Rafi is asking for a friend. Congrats, Rafi. Really, congratulations. I mean, I hope that, how you said, you can't even say congratulations because that means that someone died, right? I should say congratulations. But Rafi, if I were you with this 100K, or if it was me, I would not invest it. If no. I needed it 2 to 4 years for a down payment, I would put it on the bank, maybe a deposit that gets released in 2 years from now. I would not touch it. I would not touch it. Yeah. Imagine that now the I mean, 2008 will happen over the next 6 months. Forget about having your money quickly back. I would never invest that money. Never.
Yeah, but there could be some government saving schemes or government bonds that are guaranteed within 2 to, like, I know in Ireland we have these.
Yeah, okay, but this for me is similar as a savings account and you put it on deposit. Yeah, exactly.
So that's as far as I would go. I would not put it in the stock market. That's for sure.
Not at all.
Eric has asked us about real estate investment trusts. They were down, obviously, because of Powell's announcements, but they have rebounded since Friday. Any idea, oh boy? I have no clue.
Maybe investors saw this opportunity. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Harry has asked us about Chesnara. How risky do you actually think they are?
They are quite risky for two reasons. One, it's a micro cap, so it's not easy to get rid of the shares. Yep, under stress during volatility. Secondly, maybe what people need to know, they pay like almost a 10% yield, 9% yield or something like that. It's insurance stock. What the risk in their business model is that they very much depend on buying, insurance policies from other companies that want to get rid of it. So the question is really like, how much can they acquire? Against what terms and how much value they can create out this. So it's really not an easy company to analyze. And that's probably where the biggest risk is. Do you really know what you own? So that it's just a hard stock to study. And yeah, that's why for me the risk is high there.
We got a question from Sebastian about M&M Software. I'll let you pronounce the full name.
Mentioned Machine Software from Germany. So first of all, I really like that it's a CAD/CAM software provider. I don't know if you ever work with CAD/CAM software, but effectively it allows you to design facilities. So when you think about those 2D and 3D models that you have, so whether it's designing a bridge, a highway, an office, a machine, that's what CAD/CAM software is. And you know, the world is becoming more and more industrial. Capital projects continue to be there. So, and they seem to have a pretty good solution there because their sales just continue to grow for many, many years, since 2014. They have doubled their sales annually, 10% growth. So it's doing it really, really well from that point of view. 2022 to 2023 didn't see the highest growth. But this is definitely a stock to research further. Also, the dividends, I think they were paying 65 cents like several years ago. And now is it 160 or 165? So also a fast dividend grower. I think it's a very interesting company. I've looked at it once or twice. I don't know why I didn't invest in it as such, but it is an interesting company for further research.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with Cadrons. As you can imagine, engineer, it's quite important to know how to use that type of system. I'm not familiar with that name. Autodesk is the software that is popular over here.
So. You're not familiar with it? Okay.
Not with that. Autodesk is the only brand that I've ever used, and it's anyone I've ever seen in college and all use Autodesk. And I don't know if they are part of this company or not, but it's just the only company I know.
Okay, okay.
So the next question is from Adrian, and he's asked us for our thoughts on Kimberly Clark.
Yeah, I had them in the past. I sold them for this simple reason. There was hardly any growth there. And it's, I said, dividend payout ratio was quite high. So, yeah, that's effectively the reason. I will not go back there quickly. I don't see how this will change anytime soon. So, yeah.
Yeah, they've got a nearly 4% dividend yield and 3% dividend growth. So,
yeah, it's not enough for me. It's not enough. How about you? Same reason?
Yeah, pretty much. I have a lot of consumer staples as well that offer me better growth. So,
okay,
not on my list.
I wanted to, by the way, come back to mentioned machine, because I'm now looking at their product portfolio, just because you mentioned like Autodesk and
yeah
they have Autodesk Inventor, Revit, Construction Cloud, AutoCAD.
Okay,
so you're a user of this because
yes.
Already they are Autodesk right there, but I was not 100% sure.
Yeah. Okay. And in that case, I'm very familiar with their products. I've used Revit and Autodesk. So I just never knew that they were the
So what's your engineer opinion on these products?
I love them. I love them. Like CAD, Autodesk CAD is
okay.
The best product. Like, I don't know any engineering company that needs to do CAD drawings that does not use it. I've never come across.
So I see your eyes twinkling, which means you should put it on the list for a deep dive.
Well, I think so, yeah. I think that's definitely worth it because, I never knew that was the parent company of Autodesk. So, nice one. That's why we love listeners' questions, by the way. Thomas asked us about companies such as OpenText and Amdocs. I'm not too familiar with these. They are in the tech sector. I don't know. Maybe we might add them to the list as well. But Wolf has asked us about the drop in semiconductors. Do you think this is a healthy correction or the start of a wider sell-off?
I think it's just a correction. I mean, some of them really went ahead of it of themselves, because all the great earnings that they had, but you know, at a certain moment, the multiples just become too big, too high. So I don't see them. I think it's a healthy correction because the underlying growth trends are very, very strong. So it's good actually. It's good that they sell a bit off, and I think something like Nvidia. I mean, it's such a tricky one because they are on fire, really on fire. But how long can they grow like that, right? So it's good that it's cooling down a little bit, this industry.
Yeah, and we spoke about ASML. The first half of the year is quite slow, and they've mentioned other companies are slowly rebuilding. So maybe that's part of it as well. So,
yeah, exactly.
See. So that's the end of the show. Thanks to everyone for all the questions. One particular is the one around the Autodesk company. So I'm not going to try and butcher that name. And I butcher enough names on this show, but I've added that to my list to do a deep dive. Look, hope you all enjoy the show, and we will see you all.
Remember, both of us at Dividend Talk are not certified financial specialists through formal education. We are just two guys sharing our journey for inspiration and entertainment purposes. Hence, this is not investment advice. Although we do our best, we can't promise that the information discussed is always correct, nor appropriate for you or anybody else. We always recommend that you do your own due diligence and be accountable for your own choices. As we always say, you can't borrow conviction from others. Last but not least, by listening to our podcast, you agree to hold us harmless from any ramifications, financial or otherwise, that occur to you as a result of acting on information provided in this podcast.